Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm very pleased to say we have Elizabeth Abel on the show, and we'll be talking about her new book, Signs of the Times, The Visual Politics of Jim Crow. I'm just slightly too young to have ever seen a colored-only or white-only sign, but I know about them through photographs. They are very frequently reproduced in books, particularly books about segregation and desegregation. Interestingly enough, I've never read anything scholarly about them, and I really didn't know much about them except that there were photographs. The great virtue of Elizabeth Abel's book is she brings a lot of them together and she contextualizes them. She discusses the way in which they were used to demark space and race together. And in that sense, her book is a great contribution to the understanding of the way in which Americans experienced race, particularly in the South, in the era of Jim Crow. Not to mention the fact that the photographs themselves are often very arresting and the stories of the people that took them are often very interesting. So the book offers a number of different things to students of history and African-American studies and photography and even literary criticism. I really enjoyed the book, and I enjoyed talking to Elizabeth today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Without further ado, here it is. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm fine, and you?
I'm very well, thank you very much. Today we're talking with Elizabeth Abel about her book, Signs of the Times, The Visual Politics of Jim Crow. As I told Elizabeth in the pre-interview, one of the fans of New Books in History wrote me and said, there's this terrific book out about segregation signs. I guess that's what you'd call them. And after an email correspondence with that person, I got in touch with Elizabeth, and she quickly agreed to do the interview, and I got the book, and I read it, and I have to say it's very gratifying and very interesting. I'm just slightly too young to have ever seen any of these things in action. I, of course, have seen pictures of them. They figure very prominently in, I guess I would call it the discourse or the narrative of segregation and anti-segregation. And as Elizabeth points out, very interestingly, they have a kind of second and even third life where they are used as symbols to be manipulated. I guess manipulated may be too strong, just used for one purpose or another. And she traces the history of them just from the very beginning to these moments today when they are being deployed again in entirely new contexts. So it's a very interesting project that tries to describe the kind of migration and meaning of these really interesting and I must say sort of disturbing signs. That's just between you and me, Elizabeth. I'm sure you feel the same thing. Before we get going on the book, why don't you do me the favor of saying a few words about yourself?
Sure. Perhaps the first thing I should say is that I'm not actually an historian. I came to this project somewhat circuitously. My background, actually my PhD is in comparative literature, and I've been teaching in English departments all my life.
Elizabeth, hold on just one second. Can you move the microphone just a little bit away from your mouth?
Okay.
Because we're getting what's called plosives. You know what the right plosives. Remember linguistics? I think that's what they're called.
Sort of.
Yeah, plosives. So in other words, it's banging against the microphone. But if you move it away from your mouth a little bit or kind of up toward your nose, it won't do that.
Yeah, that's what I've just done.
That's perfect right there.
Does this sound better?
Oh, yeah, sounds much better. Yeah, so we're not getting those anymore. So just go ahead and start from the I'm not a historian.
Okay.
But we're going to make you a historian anyway, so go ahead.
Perhaps the first thing I should say about myself is that I'm not actually an historian, and I came to this project in a somewhat circuitous fashion. I'm actually a professor of English, and I have a degree in comparative literature and have taught ever since then in departments of English, not of history. So I have some anxieties about presenting myself as an historian, or perhaps I should say, rather than presenting myself as an historian, I would like to think of myself as a visitor or a migrant to the field of historical and cultural studies.
How about a welcome guest?
Oh, well, thank you. That's a much better image. I like that. And I guess I hope what my different training and background might be able to bring to the field is a distinctive focus on the language of Jim Crow. And I mean by that both a verbal language, of course, the language of the signs themselves, and a visual language, how the signs got translated into images by the photographic cores and practices that have preserved them and brought them to our attention, because the signs themselves have fortunately almost entirely vanished, and we know of them through the intervention of the camera that has made them visible to us today.
Mm-hmm. What has been written on these signs before? Is there a literature on them?
You know, there is so little. That is really how I came to this project, inadvertently almost, by finding a particular photograph that captured my attention and trying to research what had been written about the signs and the representations of the signs, and discovering to my real surprise that virtually nothing has been. They tend to crop up, mentions of the sign crop up in narratives, both autobiographical and fictional narratives of growing up in the South. And they tend to feature in symbolic moments of childhood when a young person encounters the sign for the first time as an experience of trauma and shock, and has it explained typically by a parent who unfolds the meaning of the system of Jim Crow, and then tries to steer the young person away from the experience of future encounters. So there are these episodic references, but no, or virtually no attempt to develop an understanding of a system of representation in which these signs were key. And that then became, I said, I really never intended to do this, but it became a kind of almost obsession of mine to try to piece these little fragmentary images and narratives together into a more comprehensive understanding of how this system worked, both during the reign of Jim Crow itself and subsequently, you know, for all of us who have some knowledge of it as mediated by these references.
Yeah, I like what you said about the current disposition of the discourse of the signs being sort of trapped in this trope. And it really is. I mean, whenever you hear about them, it's always in some sort of cautionary way, is that somebody comes upon them. And, you know, they're a little bit like you see the swastika. You know, it's always cautionary. It's always something that is put in a strongly evaluative and negative light. And it is stereotyped in that way today. You mentioned the catalog of photographs and signs. That seems to me to present a real difficulty. How did you amass photographs of these things? Is there an archive of them, or did somebody collect them?
No. I mean, there are mini archives scattered really across the country. But again, to my astonishment, I discovered there has never been an attempt to collect these in a single comprehensive archive that would constitute you know, an enduring representation of the way Jim Crow operated. So one of my goals in this project was to, in effect, constitute that archive, not in physical space, since the both the signs and the images remain scattered, but, you know, between the covers of a book where people could see the both the historical and geographic distribution of this system. And I guess I would hope at some point perhaps to be able to do an exhibit that of the materials that came out of this project in one space in which people could actually walk through and see firsthand how these things look, or perhaps as a web event. That might be another way.
Is that in the works?
It is not yet in the works, but it is sort of something I anticipate doing at some point.
Wouldn't that be fantastic? Fun to work on that. I mean, fun, I guess maybe I shouldn't use that word, but it does sound like a very interesting project. We book writers don't get to do that kind of stuff very much.
Right.
Yeah, but I envy you. So let's talk a little bit about Jim Crow. What is Jim Crow, and when did it start?
You know, it's even the term itself has a certain enigmatic quality to it. The name Jim Crow derived from a song and dance routine that was legendarily performed in the early 1830s and became a kind of minstrelsy act. And the refrain that is well known is, "Every time I turn around, I jump Jim Crow." That term, for reasons that aren't fully documented, came to be the generic name for the system of segregation. And that system itself, of course, was variegated and historically and geographically uneven. So there's no single starting point. But it gained momentum after the end of Reconstruction, when the federal troops withdrew from the South and local Southerners were eager to, white Southerners, of course, were eager to implement a system that would reassure them that hierarchical relations between African Americans and whites were maintained in an array of public spaces in which something more like equality had been enforced through the imposition of federal troops during the period of Reconstruction. So signage began to crop up unevenly and variously in the 1880s and 90s. The first photograph that I was able to locate of a sign was actually in 1900, but there are references to signs prior to that. And then spread in diverse forms, and by forms I mean both material forms. They were written on cardboard and painted on walls and stamped on metal and painted in windows. I mean, they extremely diverse, and also linguistic forms. Very little regulation about what the signs needed to say or could say, or how big they should be or where they should be. So these were remarkably diverse, both in their material features and linguistic features, and geographically. They were not only in the South, and certainly not only in the Deep South. Photographs document them up and down both coasts of the United States, and of course, across the nation. And so they gained momentum, as I said, sort of after Reconstruction and in the early decades of the 20th century, when they became quite insistent and virulent and pervasive. And they weren't dismantled. Well, they weren't dismantled until the last photograph that I found was from 1980. Wow. But I've since heard references to signs that linger, especially in rural environments. And there may still be some, certainly in my research swings through the South, I didn't see the signs themselves, but I did see traces of them. So those could be little marks, holes in surfaces such as marble, where they're very hard to fill in over drinking fountains. You could see four symmetrical holes, and I remember this specifically in public building. I think it was the City Hall in Birmingham, Alabama, where, of course, there's no segregated fountains, but there are what I'm quite sure are the holes where the signs for the segregated fountains had been. Or strange locations of restrooms, which seem to be remnants of previously segregated restrooms. Or one example that was particularly intriguing to me was, this was a station in Georgia. I'm trying to remember the name of the town, and it's not coming back to me offhand, but a sort of minor city in Georgia, where the train station had stairs going down symmetrically on both two sides into a waiting room, and the words "Safety First" were painted over the staircase. I think that seems like an unnecessary piece of information. Probably it's covering over where the white and colored signs had been to the two stairways into two sides of the waiting rooms. So the traces remain, and the signs themselves probably can be found on occasion in parts of the South.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the parallel with contemporary German architecture is interesting, because I know of websites where people go around and look at monumental German buildings for where the swastikas used to be.
Uh-huh.
And they, you know, people will say, you know, this building, that large space up there is where, you know, the German Imperial Eagle was bearing his swastika, that kind of thing. So it's a similar sort of thing. Historians like to talk about things coming from above and below, above being the state and below being a very popular, I want to call it vernacular sort of movement.
Mm-hmm.
My impression is that these things were more vernacular than they were. Yes.
Yes. I mean, there was legislation coming from above that said these facilities must be segregated. So that was the sort of the voice of the law, if you like, came from above. But the implementation came from below, from a wide range of places and people, so civic organizations or businesses and individuals, and this is the most vernacular version of them, would just write sort of racial signs and messages on their homes or small, you know, mom and pop stores or their in rural areas on outdoor toilets. Somebody, you know, the owner would put white paint, white only on it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what made it most interesting to me, was these signs became an occasion for, almost an incentive for, the option to produce the signage became an occasion, an incentive for the articulation of racist sentiments that became very legible and compelling to think about as popular expression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things you point out is that the signs don't only regulate, they also express an opinion about races. And you can see that some of the signs are placed in such a way, that, this is hard to do on the radio obviously, but some of the signs are placed in such a way that they don't seem to separate anything. They simply say no blacks, and there's not like any place to go. Just no blacks.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about the language of the signs, which changes. What words do they use to demark the so-called races?
Yeah. One trajectory takes place within the category for African-Americans, and of course they're not called African-Americans. One of the things that interested me was the language or the variation between the use of the word colored and the use of the word Negro. Those were the two dominant terms, colored being the primary one because it was more inclusive, it was more capacious. It could be understood to include all sorts of mixed races and often ambiguously other races. I mean, there's a whole set of discussions about where Asian Americans in the South, who were a sizable minority population, where they fit between the white and colored categories. So using the term colored could plausibly include them in the white, the word Negro could not. Similarly for Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there was a third category in certain areas for Indians or no Indians, most often not in the binary system, white and colored applied. So with the term colored, the preface to it would typically be for colored as opposed to for white, and typically it would not be used as an adjective modifying the word people. So we would have for white people and for colored in a obviously asymmetrical construction. But when the point of the sign was to bar African Americans, since the word no would be the introduction to the sign, what typically followed was Negroes, no Negroes, because colored in English doesn't function as a noun the way it was used, say, in South Africa, no coloreds. So it would become for colored or no Negroes, or in the most abusive variations, you know, even more offensive racial epithets were used. Sometimes there would be a noun that followed custom in the early decades of Jim Crow that tended to be, let's say, for colored, for white and colored patrons or passengers or some specific designation that tended to drop out later as the system became more automatic and simply the abbreviated for white, for colored what took over from that.
One of the things that you point out in the book is that these signs not only reflect the reality of segregation, but they also are telling people what to do who don't know what to do.
Right.
In other words, in the early years, people didn't know exactly what was for whites and what was for blacks. And so in that sense, the signs were they were really pedagogical. They were instructive.
Yes, primarily for outsiders, because local people living within that community tended to learn pretty fast where they could or couldn't go. But outsiders didn't, and it varied enormously from community to community. So these signs typically show up at transportation sites, especially railroad stations where people would be coming from further distances, and bus stations as well. And there they really were pedagogical. Mm-hmm. And it was important for African Americans as well as for whites traveling to be instructed, because a wrong move could be very dangerous, very risky for them.
Clearly. So the book is about photographs of these things, not the things themselves, about a representation of them. Who's taking these photographs?
Yeah, that's another very interesting set of questions for me. Mostly they were taken by Northerners, that is by outsiders coming down in the initial large movement to document conditions, living conditions, working conditions in impoverished areas. So this was mostly the first large wave of photographers were sponsored by the FSA, the Farm Security Administration, a federal agency, whose mission was to document poverty, really, to legitimate the investment of federal money in supporting, hiring employment programs and support programs. So in the 1930s, largely white, largely northern liberal photographers were coming down, really not expecting to find the explicit signage that they encountered. So the first substantial body of photographs were taken primarily by FSA photographers. And because they were outsiders traveling to the South, they tended to encounter these signs at public spaces, often transportation sites. And so the dominant image that they created, and that has remained the dominant image through our time, has been fairly standardized signage, fairly sanitized signage, produced for the eyes of outsiders. So largely these white and colored signs that have instantiated our cultural memory of this phenomenon. And in many ways, that's misleading. So because the signage was far more various than that. So local Southern photographers, people who grew up with the signs, and interestingly enough, both white and African-American Southerners have documented a far more various and, if the word is not misplaced, colorful language of these signs that were individualized, localized, regionalized, etc., and that don't have this sort of generic quality of the northern photographers. Mm-hmm. Then subsequent to the 1930s into the early 40s, the next large wave of documentation happened with the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. So initially in the late 50s, early through mid 60s, again, primarily northern photographers coming down, joining forces sometimes with local protest movements by African American. Obviously, they were doing the protesting, but did less documentation of it for a whole range of reasons. Primarily, those involving safety, those who did photograph actual sit-ins and protests, and even the signs independently of the protests, often had their cameras taken away from them, were often fined or even imprisoned or beaten up for daring to take a stand that was implied by having the camera with them. So the civil rights movement tended to venture out into more less well-trod territory and to capture signage that was more blatantly racist, less guided by the pretense of the separate but equal fiction that the Plessy case had put in place. And then after that, it just broadens to more individuated cases of people who, for one reason or another, Southerners and Northerners, black and white, wanted to capture an image of the signs before they totally vanished from the landscape.
So I find it very interesting that that most of the examples that we have are these kind of obvious stereotyped ones that you find at train stations and such. And your book does such a nice job of showing really these vernacular signs that were obviously hand-painted and express something slightly different, I think, and something rougher. That's
yes.
My impression, yeah. Something much rougher. Let's talk a little bit about where the signs appear. We've already talked about it for a moment. You have an interesting chapter in the book about the intersection of the racist signs with signs that demark gender. And here I'm speaking specifically of things like, trying to recall, drinking fountains and restrooms. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I guess I would like to lead into that by saying one of the most fascinating aspects of the project for me came to be the way that space and race are mutually constitutive through this whole system, and the way that the diverse social spaces, which will get us to the restrooms and drinking fountains in a second, played an active role in defining the system of race. So I think, again, one of the assumptions that we bring to this system is that space was basically empty or transparent or passive, and that these signs were superimposed on this kind of evacuated space.
Mm-hmm.
And mapped it racially. And, of course, that is the case. But I think there was more pushback, there was more resistance by virtue of the fact that space was also being delineated for many kinds of social functions mm-hmm. and purposes and uses. And those definitions and structures then intercepted the racial system and played an active role in diversifying it and shaping it. So that the drinking, again, I think the signs at transportation sites, the symmetrical white and colored signs, typically were over drinking fountains or got, in our memory, superimposed on the symmetrical juxtaposed structure of the two drinking fountains. Mm-hmm. And that has become our iconic image of Jim Crow, the white and colored fountains. Typically, of course, not equal, but visibly unequal, separate and unequal.
Mm-hmm.
So the parallel binary system of the drinking fountains and the restroom doors fed easily into the preconception of the binary system of Jim Crow as a separate and unequal system. And the gender signs, the restroom signs, had an additional influence in that they seemed both to legitimate as a preceding accepted normative structure, the sexual division of space, at least around functions like bathrooms. So they offered a kind of legitimacy to the racialized division, mm-hmm. and they also shaped that division because the unequal gender structure between masculine and feminine then was superimposed on and fed into the unequal racial system between white and colored, such that colored occupied the position of the feminine.
Mm-hmm.
And the ways that the photographers then consciously and unconsciously, I think, reiterated that assumption and reinforced that assumption was by typically showing an African-American man stooped to drink at the colored drinking fountain in a position of, I really see it as a kind of submission or abjection mm-hmm. to the system, unwilling, of course, mm-hmm. but enforced upon him. So the feminized, emasculated black man became the iconic figure of the effects of Jim Crow
mm-hmm.
on masculinity, the detrimental effects on masculinity. And there are almost no photographs of African-American women drinking from the colored fountain because
that's
that
so
wouldn't...
Interesting.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
That wouldn't have that added effect of saying, look at what the system is doing to men.
Yeah.
And conversely, there are very few white bodies, of either male or female, shown at the white drinking fountain because I think, again, perhaps unconsciously, the desire was both on the part of the largely white, largely liberal northern photographers to absent themselves or their own representatives from the system and to want to claim the stance of the neutral observer who's simply documenting and not implicated in the system. And because to show white subjection to the system would undermine the desire to document its effects on African Americans. That was the case for the drinking fountains and restrooms and the ways in which they collaborated in establishing the reigning set of assumptions about Jim Crow. Other social sites work quite differently, and perhaps the most dramatic counterpoint to the drinking fountains were the vertically segregated movie theaters.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about those.
Yeah, those were so interesting because they go against the grain in that it was the so-called colored balcony, the upper floors, that were where African Americans were required to sit, and the downstairs, the sort of orchestra level where whites sat. And while on the one hand, those upstairs seats were inferior, you had to climb often up a very uncomfortable exterior, sometimes fire escape, sometimes just rickety wood stairs appended to the outside of the building, and you had a less good view of the screen, so they were inferior. But symbolically, they are superior. And practically, they had certain advantages over the white audience downstairs, which was subjected to the surveillance of the African Americans upstairs in an inversion of the typical system of surveillance that Jim Crow was intended to implement. Mm-hmm. So black viewers upstairs could watch the white viewers downstairs, but could also engage in various practices such as throwing popcorn, ice cubes, anything handy down on the downstairs viewers. And by virtue of being both in the dark and upstairs and behind the white audience, they really couldn't be caught and they really couldn't be penalized for this behavior. So one of the pleasures of going to the movies for the African American viewers was to finally get some kind of revenge on the unsuspecting or at least vulnerable viewers downstairs. Mm-hmm. And the photographs of this hierarchical, vertically segregated system were especially interesting and intriguing to me because they would show either the colored, a sign saying colored balcony or colored upstairs, but often the staircase itself going upstairs to a position above the screen, which would be represented symbolically in the photograph by the poster for the film. So it captured the sense of a kind of spectatorship from above of a screen that whites would view from below, and provided very fertile ground for interpretation as a result.
I wanted to ask you about a kind of peculiar, at least to my mind, peculiar inequality or inconsistency, and that is that a movie theater is a place of public accommodation, and they were segregated in the sense that there were two parts of them. I don't think that that's true of restaurants, is it? Were there restaurants that had black sections and white sections, or were they so simply completely segregated? You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do see what you're saying, and I would say all of the above. Often, blacks were just excluded. Sometimes there was a takeout window in the rear, like in the kitchen of the restaurant, where African Americans come and often had to bring their own container for food, and it would be handed to them through the window, and they would take it home or take it elsewhere to eat. Sometimes they were just plain excluded. Sometimes there were separate sections curtained off or sometimes even walled off, a back room or a back area behind a curtain or a wall for African Americans. But the spatial allocation that I found most interesting was one that was quite common during the Depression years in the 1930s, when it was advantageous to restaurant owners to accommodate as many customers as possible, given the hard times that everybody was facing. So the most common system devised in the South during that time for inexpensive eating places was a kind of U-shaped lunch counter with a common area that the waitresses would occupy at the center, one arm, perhaps we would say, of the U was for whites, one was for blacks, and some kind of device was suspended from the ceiling, sometimes a curtain, sometimes a board, that divided the racially segregated arms of this U-shaped structure from each other right at eye level so that the waitress could serve both sets of customers, but they would not be able to look at each other for the duration of the meal because that was, of course, a taboo. You couldn't look directly at a member of the blacks, couldn't look directly at whites, which otherwise they would be doing for an hour or so as they were seated at the counter. So this very bizarre structure of a hanging device that food could be served under, but you couldn't see across, was devised during these years. And in fact, that is the image that led me to this project, was a photograph taken by Dorothea Lange in 1938 of a Mississippi lunch counter that shows an African-American couple. You just see them sort of from the nose down. A little bit of their eyes are showing. Taken from the white side of this U-shaped counter by Lange, with a device hanging down, and the caption to the photograph says, "This is the curtain that divided service between blacks and whites." And it struck me as, I was so surprised by it, struck me as such an unusual version of segregation, because like everyone else, I had grown up assuming it was the white and colored fountains fully visible adjacent to each other. That was the only structure, not just the dominant structure, but that was the reigning structure. And when I encountered this photograph, which raised all sorts of interesting questions about visual access in both directions, not just that African Americans couldn't see, you know, across the Du Boisian veil that segregated them from whites, but that whites couldn't see across it either. And Lange's photograph seemed to suggest a great deal of frustration at the system, rather than just acceptance of it. Of course, as a very famously liberal photographer, progressive photographer, she was not only outraged by it, but frustrated by it, because her mission was to see, to use her camera to see and to document all kinds of living arrangements in the South, and she couldn't see across the racial division, couldn't see fully across it. So it was this concatenation of race and spectatorship and viewing that led me to ask, so what else was going on in this system? How was it structured? How was it inhabited? How was it documented? And I thought I was writing a footnote, and then I thought I was writing an essay. And 10 years later, it turned out there was a book there.
Boy, ain't that always the way. How does that happen to us? There should be a book about that. The most famous sort of side of contention or debate about these things is, of course, one that involves eating, and it is lunch counters. And you write very interestingly about that. They become targets, really, very visible targets. Can you talk a little bit about the way you call them a theater? And they are very theatrical. I mean, everyone has seen pictures of these sit-ins, and particularly the people sitting in being mocked or attacked or humiliated in some way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. That is where the book ends, with the process of dismantling the signs through the protest movement of the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s. And I chose to focus on the lunch counter sit-ins because they lent themselves to photography so perfectly, unlike some of the more violent street demonstrations, for example. So I became interested not so much in the scenes of violence, although, of course, they took place and they are included, but in the more common experience, which was these heroic young students, primarily African-American students in the South, would go and they would sit for hour after hour, day after day, week after week, and nothing would happen. They wouldn't be served, and there would be occasional bloody attacks, but those were the exception rather than the rule. And most of the time they sat and they brought with them their school books and pens and papers, and they converted those lunch counters to study halls effectively. And the photographers would show up expecting and I suspect, hoping for some action that would translate into a dramatic photograph that would get published in the newspaper. But mostly what they witnessed was inaction. And it was because those scenes of protracted stasis became a different kind of theater, not the more dramatic version that we know so well, but one of endurance and repetition and self-conscious posing. The students were extremely aware of how they would be viewed, both by the locals who might come to jeer at them and by the photographers who typically stood behind them, both figuratively and literally, that is, stood, were on their side, but often, most often, stood behind them. Interestingly, rather than crossing over into where the absent waitresses would be, absent because they simply walked off the job rather than serving them. And so they're very haunting images of often of the backs of these students. Sometimes photographers ask them to turn around to face the cameras, which they did stoically and unsmilingly, and with a sense of the weight of history being made. So that the small things, details that otherwise might go unnoticed, for example, one little symbolic drama that I tracked was the interplay between the pens the students brought to take notes and underline their books for the many hours they were sitting there, and the cigarettes that they were forbidden to smoke during the sit-ins. There were very strict rules about what they could and couldn't do that the organizers of the sit-ins put out. So no talking, no laughing, no smoking, dress codes. So cigarettes, which were brought by the hecklers, the white local hecklers, not only as part of the local culture of smoking, of course, at that time, but as weapons that could be used to burn the backs or the necks or the arms of the protesters. So the fight between the kinds of pens and swords, the swords being the cigarettes at this time, the white cigarettes coating whiteness, the black pens coating blackness and coating the class aspirations and intellectual goals and practices of the student protesters who were in the process of moving up in the world into positions of middle class, you know, professional authority, as the white townies were using their cigarettes as the instrument of last resort to assert their racial privilege in the face of a shifting economic situation. So those mini dramas became very interesting to me. The purses that the women would put on the counter that became their self-extension in space, these contained purses, figures in my reading at least, of the presence of these women sitting at the counter at great risk, and also of the fact that money was not being exchanged because they were not being served. And so they were also images of resistance to a system that would not include them on the terms with which they demanded to be included. So those the symbolic dramas became very important to me in that set of photographs of the sit-ins.
One of the things I noted about those particular photographs, that is photographs of students simply sitting at these counters and really studying or doing something, I don't know exactly what they would you know, usually pose in some way, is that they're the only photographs in the book that really require some explanation. Because if I were to hand somebody that photo today, they would say, look, it's a couple of black people studying at a counter.
Yes.
They wouldn't have any idea what it meant, because it doesn't say – I mean, it doesn't say really anything to us without knowing the context.
Right, right. Yeah. Sometimes when I've given talks and I've shown slides of these images, but you said a little while ago, well, you all know about sit-ins. We may have, a couple of images of violent attacks in our mind, but this pervasive sense of sitting and the force, the power of that passive resistance, which we know about through Gandhi and other sites, but that the presence of these students who just are sitting with their books is very powerful and does require explanation.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I want to talk about two instances in which these images are being recirculated even today. I like to go to antique stores and stuff. And occasionally I see one of these signs or what purports to be one of these signs. And you talk about someone who even manufactures them and sells them. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. Well, many people manufacture and sell them. And that is one of the mysteries I couldn't fully crack. There is a significant industry in the production of copies of these signs, not always, in fact, often not acknowledged to be copies, but promoted as originals at a handsome sum. But where exactly they're being made, with the one exception of the person that I think you have in mind, whom I'll get to in a second, the volume of these signs, largely believed to be produced in factories in Asia, which produce all sorts of cheap memorabilia and ship it to the U.S. But when I would ask, I too was going to secondhand stores and antique stores and asking, when I'd find one of these signs, usually the seller knew it was a copy, I'd say, well, where did you get it? Or how do you get these? They said, I can't tell you. And I think there was anxiety about possible prosecution over the circulation of racist materials and the market in them being legally regulated in ways that were being circumvented in these cases. So I don't know where I could never quite crack the code of exactly who is making them and how these stores get access to them. But in one case, this is a store that no longer exists but did for about a decade, called Martha's Crib, in a suburb of Chicago. African-American store serving an almost entirely African-American clientele with lots of African-American memorabilia, but the signs are among the most popular of the items there. And I was lucky to be able to go there and talk with the owner of the store and ask her about why she makes these signs and who is buying them and why. And she explained that she was making them in response to popular demand for some tangible relic of an era that is disappearing from memory pretty quickly. So these are being commissioned, more or less, indirectly, or certainly purchased, by a generation of African Americans who grew up under Jim Crow and who want to pass on to their children and grandchildren some tangible relic of what it was like for them. So they are buying copies of these signs, hanging them at home. Sometimes, like she quotes the story of one client, a customer, I guess I should say, who wanted to buy a white-only sign to put over the bathroom in his apartment so that his son would daily have the experience of going to the bathroom and facing this reminder that he wouldn't have been able to use it if he had lived when his father did.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. I've seen those signs at antique stores. I've never actually seen one in anyone's home. There are other artifacts, I won't mention them, that I have seen in other people's homes, but never one of these signs. The second area in which these are currently being redeployed concerns affirmative action, really. And you quote John Roberts, who said something to the effect of the way to end discrimination based on race is to end discrimination based on race, or something like that. It is a memorable quote. And then you have some pictures of students who have kind of paradoxically appropriated these signs. You show Sathergate, I think, and white men only. If someone's put that up there.
Yeah.
This is paradoxical, isn't it? I mean, I had trouble wrapping my mind around it.
Sorry about that phone call, by the way.
That's okay. Don't worry about it.
That particular demonstration was in response to the various California propositions doing away with affirmative action, both in admissions processes and in hiring in the state of California. Mm-hmm. And they were posted both by students, the white men only signs, both to signal the consequences of doing away with affirmative action, that we would revert, in fact, as a university to a white-only institution or something close to that, if the intentional decision to make sure that affirmative action was attended to in the admission process. He's disappeared. So it was sad that this was a kind of cautionary tale of what we would return to, and also, I think, a reminder that this myth that we no longer have racial discrimination because we don't have these explicit signs is mythic, that racial discrimination operates in many, many ways, even if it's not written on the walls of our buildings anymore. And so by bringing the science back into visibility is a way of saying, we assume them even when we don't see them. And so the shock value of being forced to read them, to see them, to walk under them, the hope is, certainly the intention is, to wake people up to our less conscious operation all the time under the sign of Jim Crow, whether it's marked there or not.
I see. Do you think that's effective at all? Do you think that people still remember that kind of thing and understand the reference?
I think that it certainly makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah, it does, definitely.
Whatever degree of historical knowledge they have or not, they don't want to have to walk under a white men-only sign.
Yeah, no, that's clear. I mean, it's, again, the deployment of the swastika or the word Nazi or fascist is often is this sort of thing. It's a distancing mechanism. You use it to label somebody that you really don't like in a kind of broad way. I did find it very interesting, though, because it does have this sort of paradox. We are we're edging toward equality, yet we're still kind of trapped in this symbolic universe, and it's a kind of a tough thing. Let me thank you for being on the show. It's really been terrific talking to you. It's a wonderful book, and I would like to ask you to answer, if you can, our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, Elizabeth, what are you working on now?
Well, as I started up by saying, I'm really not an historian, and so I toyed with the idea of pursuing a project. I may still do it, but it's kind of moved onto the back burner. I was going to call it something like the traffic in race between the United States and France, in which, of course, a lot has been written already about expatriate African Americans who moved to Paris in search of a less discriminatory lifestyle, and that's fairly well mapped terrain. But I was interested in the converse of that, which is primarily French intellectuals coming to the U.S. after the Second World War, and I'm thinking specifically here of people like Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre, and others who came and wrote books about America in which Jim Crow features much more visibly than it does in American studies of America at that time, or at least they were, if not taking the photo, they were writing about the effects of these signs. So just and this came out of the research I was doing on the signage. One piece of information that was interesting to me is that one of the early books, it's Stetson Kennedy's Jim Crow Guide to the USA, which he tried heroically to publish in the US in the late 1940s, shortly after the war, was turned down by, I think he told me, a dozen publishers, and was finally published in French translation in a series edited by Jean-Paul Sartre in Les Temps Modernes. So in which these white and colored signs were somehow being translated into a French intellectual context. And I found it very interesting in a kind of counterpart move at the same time that Simone de Beauvoir's writing of the second sex and about the second sex specifically cites the effect of racial segregation during her visit to the U.S. In the late 1940s, seeing that signage really in a kind of reversal of what we normally think of about how gender division reinforced the racial division, seeing the racial division really inspired her in many ways to see women as the second sex in a comparable position to the second race. So I was very interested in those acts of translation back and forth. But I really am a literary critic, and I find that I'm being pulled back to my original field, which is British modernism. Specifically, my first book was on Virginia Woolf, and I find myself being lured back to questions of modernist. I'm interested now in questions of modernist memoirs and autobiographies, and that may preempt this other project.
Yeah. Well, I would just warn you against writing a footnote that turns into an article that turns into that's 10 years right there.
Right.
You're just done.
Exactly.
And that's happened to me so many times. Somebody really should write an article about that.
That's right.
I don't know what it is. You know, we were talking in the pre-interview about how strange academics really are. I mean, I always say that academics are different than other people in the sense they can sit longer in one place than other people. I think that's probably true. But anyway, Elizabeth Abel, I want to thank you very much for being on the show. The book is Signs of the Times, The Visual Politics of Jim Crow. Elizabeth, thanks again.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Elizabeth Abel about her book, Signs of the Times, The Visual Politics of Jim Crow. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.